Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan Political Podcast. Director Dave Duleo of the Oakland University Center for Civic Engagement and reporter Russ McNamara of Detroit's public radio and NPR station describe the issues Democrats and Republicans are honing in on this spring. The MERS team was also joined by Republican Commissioners Rhonda Lang and Aaron Wagner of the state's Citizens Redistricting Commission. The panel recently changed 15 state House districts in response to federal judges ruling that several Detroit area districts they first adopted were racially gerrymandered. But Lang and Wagner have some concerns about how the do-over went down. State Representative Andrew Fink, an Osseo Republican, explains why he believes talks on immigration status are inescapable when it comes to a man arraigned last week on felony murder charges in Grand Rapids. The man was a Mexican citizen, was reportedly in the country illegally, and admitted to shooting his girlfriend multiple times in the head. Now, here's MERS podcast host Samantha Schreiber, and joining for the first and third segments, MERS editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for warming up today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Also, yesterday, which was Sunday, March 31st, was Mark's birthday. I would love to wish Mark a happy late birthday and thank him for being my podcast partner in crime. Now, we are kicking things off with a roundtable conversation featuring Oakland University political science professor David Duleo, who also serves as the director of the Oakland University Center for Civic Engagement. Hey, Dave, how are you doing?
Good, Sam. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing fantastic. Additionally, I'm super excited to have one of my broadcast friends on the show this week. We have Russ McNamara of Detroit Public Radio. Hey, Russ, how are you today?
Doing great, Sam.
But before I dive into why I have you two on the podcast today, I want to begin with a question about what is on your minds going into April in Michigan's political ecosystem, or because it is a developing election year, I'll call it Michigan's political coliseum. That could be a fun name. But really, what would you say is a story in Michigan politics that unfolded last week or any time that either you personally were thinking about or you heard other people discussing through the Easter weekend?
Well, Sam, I'm happy to report that last weekend was, at least in my circles, was not focused on politics, but on college basketball. And the Tigers 3-0 start, all by one run, I think, which is historic, actually. But if we're talking political stories that are going to be important, I would point you to a couple. Number one, U.S. Representative Wahlberg's comments that have picked up a lot of attention over some geographical markers that were used to describe how he hopes the war in Gaza is quickly resolved. So when we can dive into that, the politics of that. But I would also go back a little bit and say that State Rep Matt Maddox tweet leading into the Sweet 16 here in Detroit about some buses and a plane that he tried to connect to immigration, illegal immigration. And I think that is it's going to reverberate for multiple reasons. So I would point you to those two.
No, and just to confirm, so with the U.S. Tim Wahlberg situation, now that kind of surfaced over the weekend, correct? Like Friday night, Saturday is when I think I saw it in the in the Twitter, now X sphere. But didn't he essentially say that when it comes to, you know, Gaza versus Israel, that we should do a Hiroshima? Didn't he say that more or less?
He referenced Hiroshima and Nagasaki as how he would like to see the war in Gaza proceed, maybe. Now, it was taken as he is advocating for dropping a nuclear bomb on Gaza. Mm-hmm. And of course, he disputes that and just is saying it was a metaphor, and he hopes that it points to the fact that it would just be over quickly, right? You know, and we'll leave it to your listeners to determine. And I would say listen to the whole clip because it's out there. You know, the whole remarks that he made at this event, and your listeners can determine sort of where they think he's coming from.
Yeah, I was gonna say, and I think that something that, you know, belies that whole thing is that you know, even aside from the Hiroshima and Nagasaki comments, he is not an advocate. He does not want to help the people of Gaza at all. These are, you know, 30,000 civilians already killed in this conflict and left basically with nowhere else to go. And he's not offering them any support whatsoever, which is a very strange thing to say during Holy Week, I think. And I don't really understand. I mean, I can understand where he's maybe coming from with the initial comments, but the overall lack of empathy and regard for the people of Gaza, I think it is a really bad look, I guess, if we're going to put it lightly. It just seems kind of weird. He wants the conflict over quickly for Israel, which certainly is, you know, maybe a legitimate take, but to show a complete disregard for the people that are actually in Gaza is kind of startling, I think.
I think for me, and I'm going to kind of do a pivot away from that conversation, if that's all right. But yeah. I know that when I introduced you all, well, when I had talked to you all about coming on the podcast, I really described last week as a week of issues. And this was before the Wahlberg comments began to surface on social media. But what I've been thinking of is how three U.S. secretaries came to Michigan last week. You had acting U.S. Secretary of Labor Julie Sucom to discuss developing federal standards for a battery manufacturing apprenticeship. You had U.S. Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm announce a $1.2 billion federal loan to Holtec International to restart the Palisades nuclear plant over in southwest Michigan. And you also had U.S. Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services Javier Becerra came to talk about reproductive freedom and in vitro fertilization. So I think I'm wondering, as you kind of saw like these, do I dare say, Biden surrogates traveling around the state throughout last week, which message was the most effective of those three pools? What do you all think about these visits? And you can go in any order.
For me, I don't know if any of them really move the needle. I mean, when you send surrogates out like that, you'll get, you know, a blip of news coverage. I know former Governor Granholm stopping by and, you know, will make announcements, and that will get some extra news coverage. I think that maybe the lasting policy thing is restarting a nuclear power plant, because, I mean, that's huge as far as energy production in the state into reaching those clean energy goals that Governor Whitmer wants to, because with a lot of people up against solar power and wind power in the state, if you want clean energy, nuclear power is the only way that's going to happen. Now, there is a considerable amount of pushback on the far left because of that, because everybody was raised on Three Mile Island, the China syndrome, and Chernobyl. But things, you know, are slightly different now with nuclear power generation. But I think as far as lasting policy, I think for me, that's it.
You know, I guess I'll take a little bit of a different spin on that, Sam, and say that for me, it's the Becerra visit. And I think that's only because I think that abortion is going to be, it's going to receive a lot of attention from Democrats over the campaign cycle. That's going to be an issue that they continue to revisit again and again and again, in part because I think that's one of the only issues right now that Democrats have in their favor. And I think they're going to try to capitalize. And I think that, you know, this is the first of many surrogate visits, mentions, what have you, about this, the broader issue of, as you put it, reproductive rights.
Yeah, I mean, I think the IVF conversation is really interesting, at least from a reporter perspective. And you hear these stories of individuals trying to start families and how much money they personally invested into that journey, sometimes going through several rounds of IVF and then having to terminate that pregnancy because it was an ectopic pregnancy or there was a heart defect. I mean, those are just a few things that I covered last week when I reported on that visit. But I just wonder, you know, is the IVF subject really sticking with voters in the same way that you had Roe v. Wade overturned in 2022 and so many people turned out to the polls for that specific issue? But I just wonder if Democrats are on a bit of a mission to recreate that energy And how do you do that? And is this the subject to actually do that?
So I think that that's a really good point. And I would say, yes, they are absolutely out to recreate that energy. I thought the secretary's comments were interesting when he was here. And because he said a lot of people think that the Dobbs decision was just about abortion, and it's not, right? So he's trying to connect IVF, other issues to that Supreme Court case, right? And I also think, too, importantly, politically, it puts Republicans on their heels, right? It creates a bit of an uncomfortable position for Republicans to have to be in. And Democrats always love that when they can do that, and vice versa, by the way, right? So.
Now, and I was going to say, I'm surprised that this story specifically isn't registering more with Republican voters. And it is to some extent, because these are people who want to have a family. These are people who are actively trying to have more children. And, you know, yes, there's a cost there, but there's a very strong personal and emotional toll that comes along with that, riding the highs and lows, even outside of the cost. And so for families that have been trying to have children, this really registers, and there are more people out there than you'd think who are looking for IVF.
I think one thing that's interesting about also the Julie Sue visit, the acting Secretary of Labor, that I thought was interesting is I think Democrats are also on a path of how do you also turn some of these environmental subjects into a appealing labor and economic potential argument for them. You know, so right now, let's go down to the legislative scope, right? You had the Michigan legislature led by Democrats, and you have the governor approve the clean energy 100% by 2040 package. And kind of recently, following that bill signing, you saw the Michigan Public Service Commission approve a rate increase for DTE. So it kind of gave Republicans this like pot to say like, oh, you know, look at what's going on right here, that this clean energy actually means making energy rates more expensive and decreasing the accountability for utilities as they look at rate push and rate upticks. You know, and I think with Julie Sue's visit, talking about this battery manufacturing apprenticeship, these federal standards, I think it's this attempt to say by promoting clean energy, by promoting EVs, by promoting these battery operations, we're going to offer jobs where you're going to have a high earning potential. I wonder how well does that work in their favor within less than a year to go to get voters to actually cast a ballot with that being an influence?
I guess I'm of the opinion that anytime you have to explain something to voters, it's likely not that it's not going to work out for you as well as you might think, right? I mean, it's a look, and EVs and batteries are on everybody's mind because of Goshen and the other elements that are in the state that are more, I think they're more top of mind, and I think they're simpler, right? Where it's a one sentence or half a sentence description. As soon as you start to have to explain to voters beyond a sentence, and I'm not saying that voters are stupid. They're absolutely, in fact, I think just the opposite, but attention spans are short, right? And anytime you have to explain something, that's not the position you want to be in, right? Well, we have these battery plants, and EVs are eventually going to be good for us. And then, you know, and we're going to have these jobs and apprenticeships, and that's too long, right? In my view. So I don't think it's going to resonate. But you know, they got to try something on that issue.
And that's part of the problem with something like the CHIPS Act that Biden, you know, passed, is that you're not going to see the actual impacts for years down the road, which, you know, puts you in a tricky situation. So you're in the process of trying to sell it as you're rolling it out, and it's not going to be easy. Obviously, the labor secretary is, you know, kind of pro-labor, and so they want those jobs to be union jobs. But I talked with Michigan GOP chair Pete Hoekstra last week, and he talked about finding inroads with union members, because they think they can make that a wedge issue with that transition to EVs. Like, even auto workers are not necessarily behind it. So I don't know, that's we're in the beginning stages of the push and, you know, the fight over the next several months for those votes. It's going to be fun to and interesting to see play out.
And it takes us back to the UAW endorsement of President Biden, I think, because Sean Fain was there at that event with the acting secretary and clearly is trying to bolster the union element of these battery plants, right? And trying to sell it to his members, who I think he knows aren't all on board with Joe Biden, right? Russ, I think you're on the money with wedge issue. I think that Republicans are going to try and currently are, and in the past have had success, let's say, driving a wedge between different factions of the, whether it's UAW membership or auto worker constituency.
Based off of the conversations you're having right now, I mean, what do you think voters in Michigan have the biggest appetite for right now?
Oh, gosh. Immigration, I think, is important for reasons we might get into here in a bit. And I also think that regardless of the consumer sentiment data that is showing an uptick, that people are feeling a little bit better about the economy, I think inflation and maybe the results of the last few years of inflation, right, is still top of mind for people. And you talk about, you know, conversations over the weekend, right? I mean, it's holy smokes. I went to the grocery store to shop for Easter brunch, and I can't believe how much it cost, right? I mean, I think people still have sticker shock, and inflation is coming down. Consumer sentiment is going up, but prices are still high. I think that's an important thing to consider.
Yeah, inflation, PTSD, and there's no other way to get around it, because, you know, you go anywhere and it's like, man, that costs more than it should. That costs more than it should, and you know it's never going back down. Right? Prices don't recess. Corporate profits are way up. That's changed a little bit. It's like we're seeing an enormous growth in corporate profits, but that, you know, is not being trickled down to the consumers right now. So that's a huge part of it. And, you know, I hate basically boiling everything down to it's the economy, stupid, but it really, really is. And Dave, I don't know about you, but I mean, it seems like there are some parallels between now and the George H.W. Bush period, where it's like the economy was seemingly getting better in the final year of Bush. By that point, people were so tired of trickle-down economics and all that, that, you know, nothing was really going to allow for him to be reelected.
And you just wonder if it's too little too late.
Right.
Right. In where things are headed. I think opinions are baked in on not only the two candidates at the presidential level, but maybe some of these issues, right, that are just going to be, it's going to be tough to see any real movement on them.
Yeah, I think, and I am definitely not a economist. I did not do so hot on my high school economics course. but I do think that the way, at least from the reporter perspective, that the way that we cover sentiments about the economy, I think that game has to change. I think sometimes you look at unemployment rates like, oh, unemployment rates are low, economy is good. But I think when it comes to workers, I think it's also talking about individual earning potential and what is their buying power. So I think while you may be employed, if these households feel like while they are a household full of people that are participating in our labor force, but they feel like they still struggle to buy everyday necessities, I think that's where you go into a whole new economic discussion.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting way to put it, Sam. And it'll be interesting to see how this issue is covered moving forward, right? I think because the Biden administration wants to tell people that the economy is doing fine, right? And they will cite those macroeconomic indicators, and people just don't feel it, right? They don't perceive those to be, number one, important if they're, as you put it, buying power is less than it was, you know, 4 years ago. So I think that's, it'd be really interesting to see how it progresses.
And I think something like that takes, you know, just time. You don't feel good about the economy, you know, on a month-to-month basis. This is something like, well, if I go out to buy something and I've been saving and I can purchase it, okay, now you're paying attention. When do people pay attention the most about their buying power? Sure, it happens weekly at the grocery store, but also the closer you get to Christmas, you know, major holidays when you're out there buying gifts, and it's like, okay, now you're really paying attention to prices and what you can get. And so that's too little too late for Joe Biden if he has to wait that long to get that kind of economic indicator.
You know, and I guess I would add to, and let me echo, right? I am no economist, right? I'm just a consumer, right? I mean, and like everybody, but you start to look at summer vacations and, you know, where are you going to go and how much is it going to cost to get there? And you know, what are hotel rates or how much does a Airbnb cost? And what am I looking at?
What is the price tag of my patio beer?
Yeah,
right.
The all-important Michigan summer question.
Right.
No, I do want to go into immigration, though. And I know that we're going a little over time, but we have to talk about it, especially now that, obviously, let's talk about the recent death of 25-year-old Ruby Garcia in Grand Rapids. And it's a really tragic incident that I would make the prediction we will continue to see amplified in the political conversation. Her boyfriend, Brandon Ortiz Veit, was arraigned last week for felony murder charges in relation to her death. He was a Mexican citizen and deported in 2020 following an arrest for suspicion of drunk driving, as well as driving on a license that was suspended, revoked, or denied. And according to the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, he re-entered the United States at an unknown date and location without inspection by an immigration official. So flash forward to late in the evening of March 22nd, when his girlfriend's body, the body of Ruby Garcia, was discovered on the west shoulder of the U.S. 131 highway in Grand Rapids. And state police detailed in a probable cause affidavit that it appeared she had been shot in the head and run over by a vehicle. And now you see this topic of immigration kind of come home, but there's other topics at hand too, domestic violence being a big one. I think what's kind of going through your thought process as, like I said, the prediction that this is going to be amplified in the political arena?
Well, I mean, this is something that Donald Trump has been hitting quite hard. This is something that Republicans have been hitting quite hard. This is exactly what Donald Trump wanted when he torpedoed a deal on a border security bill. He called the shot there, and then Republicans got cold feet and they backed out of it. How much that really would impact things here in Michigan, a border security bill like that, that remains to be seen, but it's not going to be anywhere. And this is just kind of playing into what Donald Trump wanted from the start, so he could use this as an issue going forward. Because if nobody does anything to, you know, change the circumstances, what's happening at the border, then you can easily use it as like, well, they're not getting anything done.
Yeah, boy, you know, I think that this is one of the easier things to look forward and talk about, right? Yes, Sam, I think the answer to your question is it is absolutely going to be returned to again and again and again. It is, as Russ says, right, exactly what the Trump campaign wants. And it picks up on other stories of illegal immigration from around the country and brings it back home and makes it hit closer to home, right? I mean, and for Grand Rapids residents and folks in Kent County, you know, it is front and center. Given some of the shocking details about this apparent murder, alleged murder, it's only going to stay in the news. And I think not only what Trump wants, but it's going to help Republican congressional candidates. Mm-hmm. It's going to help the U.S. Senate nominee.
Republican legislative candidates as well that are using this to continue to kind of amplify their message of already being proponents of a sanctuary community ban in the state.
But and one of the strange things for me is that, you know, we are, you know, a couple thousand miles away from El Paso and, you know, where a lot of this issue is really happening. And we're using the murder of Ruby Garcia as a way to show it's like, well, the border is unsecure. But, you know, Michigan has a very healthy migrant worker population, especially during the summer. And this only comes up 2 to 4 years, depending on the cycle. And it's not really an issue. I mean, this, you know, this is like the confluence of like intimate partner violence. And, you know, here's somebody in the country illegally, yet they have easy access to a firearm. And so we tend to focus on, well, this person shouldn't even be in this country, when there's issues with intimate partner violence and easy access to firearms happening every day for a lot of people that, you know, were born and raised in this country. And so it's interesting to see if Democrats can muster any pushback. Historically, they haven't, because they're more than willing to, you know, go along with saying, yes, the border needs to be more secure, rather than, you know, pushing back on some of the darker and the more racist aspects of the quote unquote call for border security.
You know, Russ, I think that's interesting about gun policy and domestic violence issues, right? That is, again, though, right? I mean, those are, and I don't mean this maybe the way it's going to come off, right? But those are secondary issues in this story, right? Mm-hmm. It's not the first thing that's going to get talked about. It's going to be that immigration angle, right? And because that's the most disturbing, most shocking, maybe, and it not that it should be, but I think that it's also immigration as, you know, a top of mind issue for a lot of Americans. That's where attention is going to get focused.
What subject do you think is more challenging for Michigan voters to connect with? Is it reproductive freedom, because voters in the state already approved Prop 3 of 2022 to enshrine abortion and other types of reproductive care access in the state constitution? Or is it immigration, because Michigan is not a border state? Well, it is one with Canada, and there are still more details of the Grand Rapids incident to surface. Which one are you choosing of the two?
I'm going to give you a terribly unsatisfactory answer, but I think it depends. And it depends on, and I'm not saying you're doing this, Sam, but we have to be careful not to think about voters or even just sort of residents and citizens as a monolith, right? I mean, some people are going to very much have a much easier time connecting with the reproductive element, right? I mean, as Russ said, there's a lot of people out there looking to have more children, and IVF is their path, right? And so that's gonna resonate with them. At the same time, others are gonna resonate with this idea of immigration. So it just depends, right? I mean, and I think that, you know, how the parties, how the candidates for office are able to sort of use those levers to see one rise at a certain time and another maybe decline. I think that's going to be interesting to see play out over the next weeks and months.
And I think IVF's, you know, value as a political talking point, it's not going to be as powerful or as obvious as the abortion rights issue was 2 years ago. It'd be impossible. And I know Democrats are kind of hanging, you know, their hat on that, hoping that can pull off some of the same magic. It might not work in Michigan. Now, it's seemingly worked in other places. In other states, it's still a hot button issue, especially in blue parts of red states. It's still a huge get out the vote sort of issue. But it'll be interesting to see if, you know, Democrats will still stream to the polls, given, you know, some dissatisfaction with Joe Biden. Given some dissatisfaction with the economy. And I don't think immigration is up as high for Democrats as it is for Republicans, but I don't think abortion is as high for Democrats in this election cycle as it was 2 years ago in the state of Michigan.
And it's certainly not, but Russ, I think you made such a good point there about turnout, right? And streaming to the polls. Well, look, there are a bunch of races in Michigan that are going to be really close in November. And it doesn't have to be Democrats streaming to the polls like they did in 22. All it takes is, I mean, it could be, right? Just a relative handful of voters who have had an issue connect with them, maybe like IVF, where that makes them vote if they weren't gonna. And two, you know, maybe reconsider a candidate who they had written off before, right? Mm-hmm. Because of that particular issue. So I think, you know, we've talked in today about big and broad strokes, but in a state like Michigan, where there, as I said, there are going to be these really close outcomes, boy, just those marginal differences could really make make or break a candidacy.
No, everybody, that is Oakland University political science professor David Duilio, the director of the Oakland University Center for Civic Engagement, and Russ McNamara of the Detroit Public Radio. Thank you so much all for joining me.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, Sam.
Had some breaking news this past week when it comes to the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission, the independent body that was created and tasked for the first time ever with drawing the state's legislative and congressional districts ahead of the 2022 elections. For those who have been following the commission and its journey toward making the establishment of these districts for elections a public task of everyday residents instead of a private job for political figureheads, serious headlines were made near the end of last year when a federal three-judge panel ruled that 13 legislative districts were racially gerrymandered. The commission attempted to create competitive seats in Southeast Michigan, and through doing so, it blended Detroit neighborhoods of Oakland County and Macomb County suburbs, resulting in federal judges ruling that commissioners violated the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. But getting to this past week, the federal judicial panel said on March 27th that there was no basis to reject the House plan that the commission spent the beginning of this year constructing to replace the racially gerrymandered districts of 2022. The plan is known as Motown Sounds and will be used in this year's state House elections. And although the federal judges gave it the green light, Black Detroiters involved in filing the initial lawsuit continue to argue that the latest House districts, the replacement districts, are not acceptable and were gerrymandered to ensure no incumbent representatives would be locked into the same district together, forcing them to compete against one another. Now that I'm done trying to summarize all things redistricting, hopefully I did an okay job, it's time to introduce our latest guest, Rural Republican Commissioner Rhonda Lang and Eaton County Republican Commissioner Aaron Wagner. Hello, how are you all doing, Aaron and Rhonda?
Fine, thank you. How are you, Sam?
I'm doing great.
Good morning.
So to kick off our conversation, you all have been referred to as some of the consistent voices of opposition on the commission. But that being said, how do you feel that the last few months have actually gone when it came to redesigning these House districts?
For me personally, I think the last few months have been a little contentious. I'm sure it's in everybody's minds that we wanted to do a good job. Some of us had been concerned about the maps the way they were drawn previously since the beginning. I wrote about it in my dissenting report when I voted no on the maps. The process itself, I appreciated the outreach, the extra outreach that was being made to the Detroit community. I also feel, though, that we really weren't hearing from the voices that we really longed to hear from, which was unfortunate because we really wanted to have a good understanding of what the community, particularly the Black community, in Detroit, what their communities of interest truly were, so we could represent that the best way we could. So it was an up and down process. At the end of the day, the commission voted on the current maps, and you know, we go from there.
Commissioner Wagner, do you have any thoughts?
Aside from, I still don't think we captured what the Black voters in Detroit actually wanted. Not really. I mean, that seems to be the consensus for a lot of Black Detroit voters, that we failed them. We didn't listen. And not only is it, you know, Black Detroit, it's rural Michigan too, because I live in an area where I'm in a farm area, and I'm grouped with MSU and Brighton. And I don't think as a community of interest, I have anything in common with either of those areas. So had I been able to vote no confidence this time around, I would have definitely voted no confidence in the maps. So I'm not happy. But then again, there's a lot of Michiganders who are not happy. So,
Commissioner Lang, what would you have liked to have seen in a map that you didn't see with this Motown Sounds map?
I think I would have liked to have seen all of the districts that were drawn based on a BVAP changed. It was still breaking up, in my opinion, communities of interest for different areas. It could have been better represented for the whole area if they would listen. It just seems like people aren't truly, or the commission, not people, they're not truly listening to what communities are saying. And I personally tried not to vote on these maps. During our break, I contacted our executive director and told him I still felt that these maps were unconstitutional. And since I said an oath to uphold the Constitution, I didn't want to vote on them. And I was told I had no choice but to vote on them. That's why my vote went to a completely different set of maps. During our public comment period, we had a gentleman from Detroit that spoke about the map that I voted for. He seemed very organic, sincere. Lots of times in this process, it's almost like there's call to actions that go out, and you'll hear a lot of people that give public comment give the same comment over and over again. So when I heard from this gentleman, it was truly like an organic comment to the commission. And even though I didn't truly believe that map was fully constitutional, I had to vote for something. So that's what I did.
Then, Commissioner Wagner, going back to 2021 when the State House and the State Senate map were constructed, what do you think happened that created the maps that were ultimately thrown out by the federal court? What do you think happened that created these maps that the court ended up rejecting?
It would have to be the racial profiling dots that we use consistently through mapping. We were constantly asking, can we pull the racial profiling dots up? I don't remember if that's exactly what we called it at the time. And good Lord, we've got thousands of hours of video out there. And trying to find exactly where it was, going through, like, there were days we were videoing for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours straight. That's a lot of time. But yes.
So why was the racial profiling, why was that such a big focus? Was that commission driven or was that consultant driven?
I think it was a little bit of both, to be honest, because most of us on the commission are not Black Detroiters. I was fortunate enough, my dad was born in Detroit, but then, you know, he wound up moving. But like Commissioner Lang, I really felt like we heard more from organizations than from the little Latina mama or Black mama that has to run 6 blocks for, you know, whatever she needs. I wanted to hear, like Commissioner Lang said, the organic comments from the Detroiters. And that I do not think is what we got. And I'm still not happy with how we have treated Detroit voters.
News outlets have described the commission as a panel of dysfunction when it comes to personal relationships. When do you think that rift occurred that created these divides between individual commissioners and their relationships of one another?
So let's see. We have, both Commissioner Lang and I have reached out consistently to Commissioner Kellum. And we supported her consistently, and as well as Commissioner Curry, because they were the voice of Black Detroit for us. But apparently, you know, it is what it is. We found out a lot in the closed session about exactly what our other commissioners think of us. So it's no wonder they chose to wait 3 months to let us actually hear it. Because had I been in that room and participating and saying the things that they were saying, I wouldn't be happy with myself either. So,
but what was said, Commissioner Lang?
There were accusations made about us trying to sabotage the commission and what have you, because we had family emergencies going on that, well, Commissioner Wagner's emergency happened during the meeting. Mine was previous, and I had even emailed the executive director about it, stating that I wouldn't be there. But there were accusations of sabotage and what have you, that we gaslight and what have you. I think what it comes down to, I can speak for myself, and maybe Commissioner Wagner might agree. There's always kind of been this, I don't exactly know what you would call it, but we've always been in a different light with the commission because we've attended remotely. They've made it an issue repeatedly. We don't understand what it's like because we attended remotely for medical reasons. So we've always kind of been on the outside looking in. There's times that we feel like our voices are being shut down. And there's times when we reach out and we get no answers. We get no resolution to issues that we have. So where it all started, it could have started from the very beginning. It could be because we are outspoken. I'm known to be a little bit blunt, and I'm not the type to get bullied. And at times, that's what it feels like it is. And lots of times, we're not in lockstep with the commission in a whole. And I think that gets held against us. My whole objective for this whole thing was to listen to people. I've always been people oriented. I've always been in a service type industry, whether it's medical, whether it's military, what have you. So quite frankly, maybe my attitude has a little bit to do about it too. I don't care what your opinions are of me. I don't care what you think. I'm here to do a job and I'm here to listen to the people.
After this commission was created in 2018, I mean, why did you personally want to sign up for this task?
To make sure it was fair. I mean, I don't know how else to say. I mean, a lot of people don't know this, and it'll probably cause a ruckus, but I voted no on the proposition. When I read it, there were too many unknowns for me. One of my issues was the financial aspect of it. You know, we're going to be paying commissioners this much money a year of taxpayer money. How do we know, you know, what is political fairness? There was a lot of unknowns, and we're changing our constitution. So to blindly change the constitution without having unknowns, you know, with having unknowns that you're not sure about personally, I voted no because I love our constitution. So once it did pass, then you get involved. You get involved. You want to make sure that the job is done right. You want to make sure the job is fair. You want to make sure the people are listened to. So you volunteer. I did, and I was lucky enough to get chosen.
I do have this question, though, both for you, Commissioner Lang, and Commissioner Wagner. I know you talked about, because you attend these meetings virtually, sometimes you feel like you get treated differently because of that. And feel free to, you know, dive into detail if you want about what you have been experiencing individually of your family emergencies. But do you think it's appropriate that commissioners can still attend via Zoom, even though the COVID-19 pandemic is essentially over at this point?
That's actually a good question. I would love to attend meetings in person right now, but I am still going through health issues where I've got doctor's appointments and everything going on like crazy. But as to that fostering any camaraderie with the two of us and with them, I don't even think, had we been present through the whole process, that we would be any more in sync with the majority of the commission than we are now. When you're getting phone calls from commissioners that are supposed to be in your the Republican Party, trying to see how you're going to vote for the incoming meeting, I don't think that's very open and transparent.
Yeah, Commissioner Lang, you want to get a crack at that? Because there has been a lot of criticism about you all still being remote, even though, you know, the pandemic's over.
Understandably so, but I think that, you know, when you look at it, it all revolves around the Supreme Court ruling that said that we do not fall underneath the Open Meetings Act. And when we didn't fall underneath it, it was voted on, okay, we'll do remote and in person and kind of a hybrid. That's the position they took. I'm thankful for it because there are instances, life happens, that has made it easier for me to attend. Say if I had to travel to Detroit, you know, to attend, it would be harder. There's situations going on. Some people still have jobs and it makes it easier. I think one of the things they talked about was they wanted to make this process open to everybody. They wanted to open up the application process for commissioners to everybody. And this aspect of it does make it easier for people to participate in it. Say if you, next time around, you get a commissioner in the UP, I imagine it'd be pretty hard for them to travel, especially if they're trying to maintain a job, to Lansing 2, 3, 4 times a month or whatever it may be, whatever their schedule dictates. So there's pros and cons either way, but I completely understand the criticism of it completely.
Executive Director Edward Woods has compared the redistricting commissioners to legislators. Is that a fair comparison?
I was going to say not at all. We were not elected to our positions. We were a random lottery. And unfortunately, I don't play the real lottery, but I seem to be really good at winning medical lotteries and things like this. So, I totally disagree with that statement.
And if I could add to that, the legislators, they've got accountability too, because if they do bad, they're accountable to the people who elected them and that can throw them out. Who are we accountable to as a commission? We are accountable to absolutely nobody. And maybe that's something that should be looked into in the future by the legislators, is maybe there needs to be an addition to the amendment stating, you know, that somebody has authority over us, whether it be an unbiased, unpolitical group or something, to give oversight, because who keeps us in check?
I want to ask about the cash. On March 21st, you two opposed giving commissioners a raise from $39,825 annually to now $55,755, which was ultimately approved, although you two did vote no. My question is, do you think you're genuinely working a job that is worth more than $55,000?
Can I start with this one? Absolutely not. If you go back and look at every vote that's been taken on the salary issue, we've consistently voted no. And for the record, I did not take this last raise. I declined it. So I am not receiving the raise because I think it's unethical. I think it's self-serving. And I think, considering the reasons that we are still drawing and we're not dormant, and to give yourself a raise, my personal opinion is it's disgusting. And that's just me being my blunt, honest self.
I totally agree with that. I think, given our huge deficit that we're looking at approaching the legislature for more money, and then vote to give yourself a raise when there's people out here in Michigan that are working 2 and 3 jobs to make ends meet. And we're basically, honestly, not doing the kind of work nowadays, maybe back when we were mapping, but I voted consistently against the raise, and so has Rhonda from day one. We signed up knowing that it was 25% of the governor's salary, whatever that was. And I just think it took a lot of hubris to decide to add like another extra $20,000 onto your own paycheck. I don't know any other organization that you can dictate your own pay.
Do you think that there are commissioners who you work with that maybe when they initially applied, they wanted to be a part of this process, but now do you think they kind of see it as a way to get some quick cash on top of any other jobs they have?
I think, considering one other time this was brought up, I did mention that there are a lot of help wanted signs out in at least my area for sure. And I imagine Detroit would be even worse, that there's no reason to suck the Michigan taxpayers dry when we're trying to do something for all of us as citizens. There's no reason to milk the cow when you don't own it.
The next phase of the redistricting commission is to take a look at the Metro Detroit State Senate districts. Obviously, there were some districts that the federal court had issues with. I think it was 7 districts in particular, 7 or 6. Have you taken a look at that yet? I'll start with you, Commissioner Lang. And how many do you think would have to be redrawn in order to satisfy the federal court?
It's 6. And okay. I have looked at the maps. However, to say how many need to be redrawn to satisfy the court, I'm not going to go out on a limb and say that. Nobody knows what the court's going to decide. We're not in their minds. So my personal goal would be that any districts, whether they're in the 6 or not, that were affected because of using the BVAP guidelines that were given to us that broke up communities of interest should be changed and reconfigured, regardless of how many districts that is. So I don't have an exact number, but I think the whole big picture should be looked at.
My question would be, what do you think? Do you think that recreating some of these state Senate districts, do you think that's going to be harder than the state House districts?
Just based on the timeline that they're giving themselves, which is like another 4 or 6 months, I've actually joked to Rhonda that come 2030 census, we will most likely still be on this stupid commission. And forgive me, I didn't mean to use the word stupid as in, you know, stupid people, but it just seems like they're milking the cow and she's already ready to be put out to pasture. So
I just want to add on to that, just for clarification. We had a schedule brought forth to us as a proposal. There's nothing set in stone. We are still waiting to hear from the judges as far as what they believe an appropriate schedule is. But what Commissioner Wagner is referring to is a schedule that was proposed, and it does go out there quite a ways and just seems ridiculous. I think that we could easily knock it out after we get the public input in a week. You're looking at bigger areas that might not be as exact as far as communities of interest. So I think, and we're looking at fewer districts potentially. So I don't think that it should take a real long time. But again, the main goal is to do right by the citizens of Detroit.
So just to confirm, are you looking at a proposal where you start working on the state Senate districts this year, or are you looking at a proposal where you wouldn't start that until 2025?
It would be this year. Yes, within the next month or two.
Yeah, I'm taking a look at your Senate map, and I see 8 Senate districts that touch the city of Detroit. You probably do half that number, don't you think? I mean, how many Senate districts does Detroit have to be a part of? You got a little bit of 7, a little bit of 11. It seems like you could probably do 4. I don't know. I'm just kind of spitballing.
I'm not going to say how many we could probably do. All I can say is to have them drawn out like that, I think we could get them in a more compact that aligns with the Constitution and something that is better representative of the population from Detroit.
Especially since we just kicked out House in a couple weeks, and Senate is quite a larger district to contemplate. So the schedule that I recall seeing said it should take us about 4 months to draw the Senate. And I'm thinking, why? Because that seems ridiculous when we just did the House. So
we are over time here, but while I have you all on the podcast, is there any final remarks that you want to give? Any additional comments you want to make to the listeners?
Well, this is Commissioner Wagner. I would love to actually hear from the citizens, not the organizations that are funding, you know, the email blasts and everything, and everybody comes and says the same thing. I want to hear from the citizens specifically on where they want the whole thing drawn. And the whole reason I like this idea to begin with was EDS originally had said that we would have a QR code and that everybody in our public hearings could click on the QR code and they could see in real time and make comments in real time. And unfortunately, that did not transpire, as well as I also asked to get Dr. Peterson from, I think, is Minnesota now, I can't remember, who had come up with a computer program that would draw the lines for you. You input whatever and it would do it. And I got shut down on that too. So it's all good.
I guess in closing, all I would like to say to the public is I hope you realize that for some, a lot of us, it's not political. Mm-hmm. Some of us truly tried listening to you, and we're going to continue fighting for you. There's varying voices on this commission, and sometimes what we believe are the voice of reasons are outvoted, but that doesn't mean we're going to stop fighting, and that doesn't mean we're going to stop listening to you. So I hope that you will speak up and let the commission know your feelings.
Absolutely.
everybody. That is Rural Republican Commissioner Rhonda Lang and Eaton County Republican Commissioner Aaron Wagner on the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission. Thank you all so much for joining us on the MERS Monday podcast. The world I wanna take hold of puts weight on my shoulders. And I just want you to know that I'm gonna stay so. For our final segment of the MERS Monday podcast, we will be featuring an interview Kyle Malin and I did with State Representative Andrew Fink, a Hillsdale County Republican and an ongoing proponent of legislation to ban sanctuary communities in Michigan, which currently consist of communities where bodies serving the local government, like local law enforcement, are discouraged from asking individuals about their immigration status outside of performing arrest. Republicans are vocally zooming in on this policy proposal after Brandon Ortiz Veit, a Mexican citizen who was reportedly in the country without permission from immigration officials, called Allegan County 911 on March 24th, admitting to fatally shooting his girlfriend multiple times in the head after an argument they had. On March 29th, Michigan Senate Majority Leader Winnie Brinks of Grand Rapids said the killing of Ruby Garcia is a tragic instance of domestic violence, and it is made even more tragic when it is co-opted by those wishing to score political points by stoking fear, xenophobia, and division. In this interview, which we conducted on Friday, Fink, who's also running a bid for the Michigan Supreme Court, talks about why he feels the subject of immigration status is what he describes as inescapable in the Grand Rapids incident.
Obviously, the primary effort in immigration policy has to come from the federal government. And that's in our United States Constitution, where it says that Congress has the authority to make a uniform rule of naturalization. And so when thinking about that, I think we both need to expect more from our federal government. But then in introducing the bill to prohibit Michigan municipalities or local governmental units from adopting sanctuary policies, my point there is that we also need the local governments and the states to cooperate with the federal government's immigration policy, or else it's difficult to have a coherent set of rules, or as the Constitution puts it, a uniform rule of naturalization. So to me, those are the important points to make, is that the federal government needs to bear the responsibility of securing the border and sort of rationalizing our immigration policy, because right now we sort of have one thing on paper and then many different things in practice. And that's not good for anybody, including people that want to move here. But we also need our local governments to recognize that that's a proper federal responsibility and that it's not fair to the rest of the country for us to have a patchwork of different policies around the country.
This past week, I spoke of Sabrina Balgamwala, the director of the Asylum and Immigration Law Clinic at the Wayne State University School of Law. And she argues that a sanctuary city, a sanctuary municipality ban in Michigan would not have prevented the death that is being looked at right now in Grand Rapids. That sanctuary city policies are essentially to make sure that regardless of your immigration status, you are participating in the everyday operations of law enforcement. So, for example, if you are a witness of a crime or if you're at the scene of an accident, you're able to talk to law enforcement without fear of them asking about your immigration status. Why don't you believe? Why wouldn't you agree with that argument?
Well, fundamentally, because, look, there are other contexts in which you might have a situation where a person is hesitant to be witnessed or something. I mean, that's not unique to the immigration debate. So, honestly, I think that's a red herring. What the policy that I've introduced, the bill that I've introduced would do is it would prohibit a municipality from intentionally avoiding cooperating with federal law enforcement on an issue where there are people breaking the law intentionally. So I, you know, again, I think that's really a red herring to distract from the problem of, again, a patchwork or a piecemeal law enforcement being adopted ahead of time. And also with all respect to the professor, I don't think that's the sole or even primary motivation of the cities that have adopted these policies across the state. They primarily think that they're being kind and that they're providing, you know, a safe haven or a sanctuary. But what I think they are ignoring is both that by refusing to cooperate with immigration enforcement, they are sort of turning a blind eye to one particular form of lawbreaking. And it's one where when we have a situation where you have millions of people in the country and we don't know kind of who they are or what they're up to, you're really preventing public safety from being achieved by any level of law enforcement. Because, you know, when you're intentionally ignoring, you know, this one category of law breaking because you're trying to kind of provide a safe haven, what you really wind up with is a disrespect for the law, inconsistent enforcement of the law, and again, an intentional lack of knowledge or willful ignorance of who's here and whether they, you know, may or may not pose a threat. Obviously, not everybody does, but we don't even have a way to sort through which ones do and which don't if we're ignoring the issue completely.
Representative of the Kent County Sheriff's Office said that the suspect in this case, Brandon Ortiz Vite, has had run-ins with the law before and has had an ICE detainer filed against him. And in fact, the Grand Rapids Sheriff's Office said that they turned him over to ICE in 2020 during the Trump administration and had him deported. Yet he came back. I mean, and in this case, he had a relationship with the victim, Rudy Garcia. Could you say that this is more of a situation of a domestic violence issue because the two had a relationship, or maybe even a gun issue since a gun was used in this offense?
Oh, I'd say that it's both. I mean, guns are used in all kinds of crimes. Again, I mean, like, I don't think it's helpful to sort of to take issues that exist in all kinds of law enforcement and sort of say that these immigration cases are really about those. What I think is more helpful is to say this. Yeah, obviously it's domestic violence if he's murdering his girlfriend. So sure, that's the category of particular crime he committed. But my complaint here is that we have a system where you have a person who's committed a crime that was removable and he's actually removed. And then our immigration system is so out of whack right now that he's not only back in the country, he's back in the country committing violent crimes. And we don't have a serious approach to this problem right now. That's what I'm looking for, is a uniform enforcement of our immigration policy, border security before doing anything else, and as a state government, not allowing our, you know, political subdivisions, the local governmental units that we have, not allowing them to go down the path of perpetuating the problem by ignoring the issue of immigration enforcement.
One thing that I saw, so U.S. Representative Hillary Shulton, she uploaded on Twitter after hearing that Trump is coming to Grand Rapids on Tuesday. She said, "Republicans are literally pushing each other out of the way to get in front of a camera and exploit the tragic death of Ruby Garcia. It's horrific. Justice for Ruby Garcia means solutions, not political theater." That's what the U.S. Congresswoman said. I have to ask you, I mean, is there a fear, though, as we try to make this incident about immigration policy and, you know, from your case, what the state could do, is there a fear or a concern that we're distracting from the death of this young woman?
I don't have any concern about that for at least two reasons. One, the bill that I introduced last week, Sam, is a reintroduction of a bill I introduced 2 years ago. In other words, this is not an issue that I've arrived at because of one tragic murder by an illegal immigrant killing his girlfriend. But secondly, I don't think that we can escape the issue by saying this tragic, and by the way, also, you know, violent and horrific incident happened. And so we shouldn't talk about the immigration status of the offender when he's someone who we've actually already removed from the country once. I mean, I think that what Rep. Skolten is trying to do is avoid talking about that particular aspect of this crime. But I didn't need this crime in order to take border security seriously, which is why I had this bill drafted. And I'm sorry, I've forgotten the date of the murder last week, but I had this bill ready to go before that. So if she or anybody else says that my bill is political theater in response to this crime, they just don't have their facts right. But also avoiding talking about one aspect of this crime is a dereliction of duty in and of itself.
Representative, I could change gears here a second. You are running for one of the nominations on the Republican side for the Supreme Court, even though under the state's term limit law, you could theoretically run four more times for state representative. Why did you decide that you wanted to run for the Supreme Court?
Yeah, Kyle, the first thing I'd say is that those two decisions for me were reached independently. I sort of determined that staying in the House for another 8 years was not realistic at this point in my life. You know, my kids are 6 to 14, and the every 2 year election cycle takes its toll. And so I had kind of determined, and probably, by the way, this is maybe an under-discussed aspect of this term limits reform, but I think that you're going to see more people step out after a couple of terms, because there is this aspect of the whole Senate thing, which I know in Representative Beeler's case has been talked about a lot, that wasn't an issue in at least my case. Or I guess Rep. Brabeck actually said that she's going to run for Senate. There's that consideration. But honestly, I think the bigger thing is when you were running before and you thought you were going to get elected for three terms, or, you know, get elected and stay for three terms and then you're done. Now that it's been extended, it actually causes you to think about it earlier. Like, well, how long am I going to stay? And so I almost think that you'll find more people say, maybe I'm going to go after a couple of terms than you would have before when there was just one left and you might as well do it anyway. But running for the court, to answer that portion of your question, which is probably the more important one. Yeah, the Supreme Court obviously is the head of the Michigan judiciary. And having someone, from my perspective, who can be a rule of law or an originalist justice and be there for the long haul in order to see that court recover the prestige that it once enjoyed as a leader in the originalist or rule of law kind of movement, which, you know, was a hallmark of the Michigan judiciary for a long time. That is critical. And having someone there with the experience that I have in dozens of courtrooms around our state in the trial court levels, understanding that when the court makes the, you know, few dozen decisions it makes a year, that impacts tens of thousands of cases, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of Michiganians every year, and understanding kind of what that's like. That's the message that I want everybody to take away, is that we need to recover the court's prior approach, and that it's going to take a long time to do that. And so having someone who's got sufficient experience to understand the impact that the court has and can carry through the project is really important.
What do you think is the biggest thing missing from the state Supreme Court's table right now?
Honestly, I think that it's a coherent judicial philosophy, which says at the outset, you know, we're going to decide this case based on the text of the law. You know, the court and the other parts of the government all only enjoy the authority that's been given to them by the people. You know, our state constitution begins by saying all political power is inherent in the people. And so having a court that maintains the separation of powers, meaning it decides the cases before it in a way consistent with the text that either the people or the representatives have given us, that's what I think we need to return to on the Michigan Supreme Court.
And then, Representative, you could run against Kyra Bolden, the sitting justice, for the remainder of the term that she's seeking, which I believe is 4 years, or you could run for David Viviano's seat since he is stepping down, which would be an 8-year term. What's kind of it sounds like another Republican candidate, appellate court judge Boonstra, is also seeking the eight-year term. How do you think that's going to work itself out as we near the convention?
Well, I've spent the last 6 months plus now running for the court and, you know, being in rooms with delegates and talking with them. And when Justice Viviano decided he wasn't going to run again, it didn't take us very long to determine that I was in the best position to lead this effort to kind of get the Michigan judiciary back on track. And again, understanding that that's going to take longer than the next term because of the makeup of the court now. So that decision was sort of easy for us to make. I just think that I'm in the best position to be the leader of this effort for the election cycle that we're in right now.
I have two questions. I think one of them, because we are in a state where people get put on ballot for the state Supreme Court based off of their success in a party-led convention. Do you think that that's kind of problematic, the way that things are done, that it kind of makes, well, that the court is not supposed to be political, the way that you end up on the ballot is ultimately political in nature and inevitable?
Well, I think that actually would still be true if we had some method other than using the parties to make the nominations if the judges are going to be elected. And so we sort of have this tension that you're getting at where our judges are nonpartisan, including at the Supreme Court level, but they do still have to get through elections. And so that means that the people have to evaluate them. And, you know, that's inherently a political process in sort of a technical sense. I can't say I think that this system makes the most sense and that if we were starting over at, you know, time one, this would be the system I would adopt. I don't know where it came from. And I often find myself explaining the oddity of it to the folks that I'm talking to. But in all honesty, Sam, my approach to that is that I'll think harder about, you know, what the best system would be at another time. Right now, I've got to run in the system that I'm in, and that's what I'm doing.
And I also want to ask a political question, because I looked at some recent polling that was done by the Republican State Leadership Committee, the RSLC, that basically found that 62% of likely November voters in Michigan picked either inflation and the economy or illegal immigration and border security as their top issues. I want to zoom in on immigration, since that's how we kicked off this conversation. Even without the Grand Rapids incident, why do you think immigration is an issue that is getting Michigan Midwestern voters wild up right now?
I think because it's fundamental to having a nation that you establish your borders and take them seriously. I mean, there have been times in our country's history where different immigration policies have made sense and we've had different waves of immigration and everything. But what people often kind of fail to appreciate is that those were decisions made by the people. And what we have right now are people who expect one thing, but have been for a long time now been given another. And so I think that they're tired of that. And they recognize that with the porous nature of our southern border in particular, we don't have the kind of security that you would expect from a country with the capabilities we have, especially knowing that, you know, this country still has a lot of enemies around the world. So to me, that's the simple answer, is that it's an intolerable situation to have, you know, a lack of secure borders when we could have them, and have sort of just by, you know, a combination of failed leadership and incompetence, we don't have them.
How much of a lifespan do you think that has in an election cycle? Like, how long do you think voters are going to be actively thinking about this?
I think they will think about it until the issue is resolved. And I mean, that would mean until we have a secure border. I mean, it's been an important issue for decades. I don't think it's going to go away until the issue is actually under control. So that my hope would be that soon, and it's no longer a politically salient issue, but that's only going to happen if we actually get some leadership. And again, that's primarily has to be at the federal level, but get some leadership to secure the border and keep our people safe.
Everybody, that is State Representative Andrew Fink. Thank you so much for joining us on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks, Kyle.
And that's going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Today's outro is a little different than most today, which I am recording on April 1st, because I am actually recording out of the Royal Oak Public Library's children's section, which is where the governor just signed legislation eliminating Michigan's 1988 statute prohibiting surrogate parentage contracts involving compensation. This policy change will allow individuals to enter enforceable contracts of surrogates who will carry and deliver their children conceived with assisted reproductive technologies. So just to clarify, what the governor just signed eliminates that prohibition that I've just described. So I'm on the scene of that right now as Governor Gretchen Whitmer signed the bills around 11 a.m. today. But as we roll into the new week, I would love to thank our numerous guests who came on. I would like to express my gratitude to Director Dave Duilio of the Oakland University Center for Civic Engagement, reporter Russ McNamara of Detroit's Public Radio and NPR station, Republican Commissioners Rhonda Lang and Aaron Wagner, the Michigan Independent Citizens Redistricting Commission, and of course, State Representative Andrew Fink, a Hillsdale County Republican. Quick disclaimer to our listeners today, this morning's roundtable conversation with Ross and Dave was recorded around 8 a.m. this morning, April 1st, and all other interviews were recorded on Friday, March 29th. I would also like to give my thanks to MERS editor Kyle Malin, who joined me on the second and third segments today, who helped me substantially with getting this episode set up. Finally, I would like to say thank you to Mark Bayshore of Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos, which is responsible for putting this audio together. Until next time, I am your host, Samantha Shriver.